Welcome to the Free the Economy podcast. I'm your host, Richard Morrison, the senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. And this is episode 69 for April 18th, 2024. Free the Economy is about how we can all become happier, healthier, and wealthier in a world with less government control. We believe in a voluntary society where consent, rather than force, governs human interactions. And while the economy we have now offers many opportunities for financial success and self-fulfillment, we know that we could do even better. Reminder that you can always find our show notes with links to the stories we cover on the Competitive Enterprise Institute blog at cei.org/blog. If you like the show, please leave us a review and follow us on Twitter at @free_the_economy. Now we're going to start by covering some recent headlines and events that you should know about, and then go on to our interview with Alexander Hammond, author of the new book, Heroes of Progress, 65 People Who Changed the World. We'll talk about the men and women who improved life for millions of their fellow human beings, from Johann Gutenberg and James Madison to Frederick Douglass and Norman Borlaug. There was an interesting article from the Wall Street Journal's Andy Kessler earlier this week on a new company that's looking to cut through red tape in highly regulated industries. Salen Churi and Brooke Fallon from Trust Ventures are venture capitalists looking to invest in business ideas that need to be liberated from regulation. Normally, investors can be expected to shy away from ideas that will only be possible if a city council or a state legislature or Congress itself is willing to pass new legal reforms first. But the reticence to invest in smart but rule-burdened ideas can mean greater rewards flowing to those who are willing to take that risk. Kessler mentions that Trust Ventures' team working on legalizing street vending in Chicago and web-enabled eye exams without an optometrist. But they're especially excited about bringing 3D-printed homes to Texas. Apparently, current fire code says that all new homes have to have a certain type of joists in their framing. Only these new 3D-printed homes are made from extruded concrete and therefore don't have joists. And why would policymakers want to go to all of the trouble of changing the fire code construction rules just for this new technology? The Trust Venture team says the construction startup they're backing, Icon, can 3D print a concrete house in 24 hours for $4,000. That might be worth making an exception for. And I bet there's other promising technologies in the pipeline, too. There's been a lot of news and commentary about electric vehicles, especially over the last week or so, from predictions that cheap Chinese EVs will take over the world to laments that the EV market is slowing down and even verging on collapse. On the one hand, EVs that are too cheap might drive incumbent car makers in the US and Germany out of business. But EVs that are too expensive will mean climate disaster because we won't achieve a net zero transportation sector fast enough. So, are we in a good place or a bad place regarding the EV revolution? Let's start with some data. According to the Washington Post's Catherine Rampel, EVs have a Democrat problem. She writes that in the past year, Democrats have become much less likely to tell pollsters that they would even consider buying an EV. She writes, quote, more companies have entered the market, so EV makers are facing more competition and squeezed margins, but customer demand has clearly cooled too. Early adopters bought their whiz-bang toys, and now mainstream America, or at least the subset that buys new cars, must be wooed. Unfortunately for EV sellers, more non-owner normies are rejecting their advances, end quote. According to Gallup, the share of Americans saying that they would not even consider buying an EV jumped from 41% last year to 48% this year. And one of the demographic groups driving this trend is among the more reliable climate-conscious customers, Democratic voters. Of course, Republicans are even less interested in buying EVs, but resistance hasn't changed that much. It's the Dems who are losing interest. This will no doubt come as a surprise to many who have promoted EVs over the last several years. After all, we're constantly told that whatever flaws they may have today, they'll, quote, only get better over time. We've also heard that most customers aren't willing to buy their first EV only because any new technology seems strange and unusual at first, meaning that as time goes on and more people see and ride in them, the public will inevitably warm up to the new models. Yet, over several years of increased deployment and visibility in the market and on roads, the demographic group otherwise most likely to buy them has actually become more hostile to them. Of course, EV adoption is still growing, but if we want to get anywhere close to the levels that promoters have confidently promised us they would reach, we're going to have to do something about the decelerating momentum of adoption. On a related note, the Texas Public Policy Foundation published a policy brief by Brent Bennett and former Texas State Representative Jason Isaac about the cost of EV subsidies. They write that federal and state subsidies and regulatory credits for EVs total nearly $22 billion in 2021, or nearly $50,000 per EV sold. According to their analysis, quote, adding the cost of the subsidies to the true cost of fueling an EV would equate to an EV owner paying $17.33 per gallon of gasoline. That number is a result of stacking the costs of multiple government programs together, including the impact of the Corporate Average Fuel Economy or CAFE program at the federal level. They conclude that, quote, EVs are being subsidized to an even greater degree than wind and solar and with less transparency because of the value of these indirect subsidies and regulatory credits, end quote. And they're not the only ones concerned about these costs. Our old buddy Alex Mercenot from episode 25 recently wrote for the Tax Foundation that if we're looking to reform the Inflation Reduction Act, as many Republicans in Congress have said they are, we should start with EV credits. The IRA's credits for electric vehicles and charging infrastructure in particular are proving to be much more costly than anticipated, costing about $180 billion, according to one estimate, over the next decade, although some estimates put that number even higher. Alex suggests that policymakers should reduce those EV tax breaks, putting reforms to the IRA's most expensive and least efficient provisions on the table. One option would be to simply cap the total cost, which is currently open-ended, or to reintroduce the previous limit of applying the credits only to a given manufacturer's first 200,000 units of production. He also mentions the more aggressive option of swapping the subsidies for the imposition of a carbon tax, though I have to admit, I don't see a future Republican majority Congress going in that direction anytime soon. Are Americans exhausted and overworked from long hours on the job? Maybe some of them, but a new survey suggests that many of us are catching our Z's in innovative new ways on the clock. Sleep Doctor, a company that sells sleep therapy and CPAP technology, recently commissioned a survey of 1,250 full-time workers in the U.S. and collected some interesting results, including that one in three workers nap every week during work hours. That same number, one-third, confesses that they miss meetings and deadlines because they are napping during work hours. One in four remote workers have fallen asleep during a meeting, and perhaps less surprisingly, three in four workers report sometimes losing sleep over job stress. Those who work remotely were found to nap the longest among full-time employees. Of those who nap, 34% of remote workers and 31% of hybrid workers nap for more than an hour on average. And remember, these are the numbers for people who freely admit to sleeping on the job. So if you're someone who worries about social desirability bias in research, those actual numbers would likely be even higher. Personally, the most surprising result to me seems to be not just the 27% of employees who say they've fallen asleep during a remote meeting in the last year, but the 17% of employees who say they've fallen asleep during an in-person meeting. That's a bold move. Or, I guess, a very relaxed one. Have you ever been in a meeting with someone who visibly fell asleep? Share your anecdotes with us on Twitter and tag us at freethe_economy. Good news for all of you with an active social life. NBC News is reporting that an early-stage clinical trial has yielded promising results for a chlamydia vaccine. There is currently no vaccine to protect against the sexually transmitted infection, which is the most common bacterial STI in the United States, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2022, there were more than 1.6 million cases. The bacteria that's responsible for chlamydia can also cause an eye infection that's responsible for vision loss in 1.9 million people worldwide. The phase one clinical trial, led by researchers in the UK and Denmark, found that the experimental vaccine was safe and successfully induced an immune response. Researchers are now planning to launch a larger phase two trial that would look at the vaccine's effectiveness. The hope is that one day the vaccine would be able to prevent both infection in the reproductive system as well as the eyes, said Jess Dietrich, a senior scientist at Staten Serum Institute, Denmark, and a lead author of the study. There are already a handful of vaccines available to treat certain sexually transmitted infections, the HPV vaccine, the hepatitis B vaccine, and the Mpox vaccine. And according to the National Institutes of Health, a clinical trial of a preventative HIV vaccine began enrolling test subjects in the U.S. and South Africa in September of last year, but no results have been announced yet. The NIH has been funding HIV vaccine research since 2004. And finally, a short shout out to the story published in the Free Press last week by veteran National Public Radio editor Yuri Berliner, in which he detailed how NPR has allegedly gone from a place for left-leaning centrism to a factory of extreme left-wing ideology. And he writes, quote, if you're a conservative, you'll read this and say, duh, it's always been that way, end quote. But according to Berliner, it actually wasn't always that way. And the network has gotten increasingly intolerant and shrill over the last several years. He points out that back in 2011, although NPR's audience, of course, tilted to the left, it still bore a resemblance to America at large. 26% of listeners describe themselves as conservative, 23% as middle of the road, and 37% as liberal. By 2023, the picture was completely different. Only 11% describe themselves as very or somewhat conservative, 21% as middle of the road, and 67% of listeners said they were very or somewhat liberal. He concludes, quote, "This wouldn't be a problem for an openly polemical news outlet serving a niche audience. But for NPR, which purports to cover all things, it's devastating both for its journalism and its business model," end quote. And of course, it's especially problematic for a news outlet that accepts and aggressively lobbies for retaining significant taxpayer funding. NPR defenders, of course, get indignant about that, insisting that taxpayer funding is only a small portion of its overall budget. But if that's the case, it should only be a small sacrifice to avoid the current controversy by renouncing that supposedly tiny amount. Berliner rather boldly published his critique of the network while he was still employed there, so not surprisingly, he's currently suspended from his editorial duties without pay. Whether he will be able to return to the place that he has worked for 25 years remains to be seen. You can read Berliner's whole piece. "I've been at NPR for 25 years. Here's how we lost America's trust," at fp.com. Those are the headlines for episode 69. Now move on to our interview with Alexander Hammond, author of Heroes of Progress, 65 People Who Changed the World. All right, now I'd like to welcome to the show Alexander Hammond, who is a free trade fellow at the Institute for Economic Affairs and the author of the new book, Heroes of Progress, 65 People Who Changed the World. Welcome to Free the Economy, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
So I always ask authors why they wrote their books, and I think the introduction of the book itself sort of alludes to this a little bit. And, you know, when I was reading, I couldn't help but thinking of the Book of Sirach, the ancient religious text that includes that famous phrase, "Let us now praise famous men." And, you know, besides the fact that now, of course, we would include famous women as well, I feel like there's the impression that, you know, in the book that to a great extent, we no longer engage in sort of the celebration of heroes and high achievers like previous generations did. Why do you think that is?
I think it's a few reasons. In the foreword, the great Steven Pinker alluded to one of the reasons, at least, and he pins it down to a kind of a post-1960s intellectual climate that deemed it, he, in his word, kind of deemed it uncool to champion the achievements of the past. And I think I experienced this a fair bit at university too. I studied history at university level for a number of years. And the big man view of history was inherently uncool. It's no. We it's not down to the individual. It's down to everything else going around it. And I think that's correct to a certain degree, but I now think we've gone too far in the opposite direction. But then there's also the media climate as well. You do get more clicks when you post negative stories. And news by definition is geared towards negativity. There's not ever going to be someone standing in a field saying a forest fire hasn't broken out today, or in whatever desert saying there's not been a war today. So those are a couple of reasons, but I just think it's fairly uncool. And I don't know if it's a bit of nostalgia when I say I don't think it's been a thing of the past, because I'm always a bit skeptical of romanticizing the past. But yeah, I think those are the main two.
Well, yeah, you can definitely see that that the sort of celebration of individual achievement of great, you know, genius or ability very much was more popular in previous generations. You can see that even in, you know, not just in the books that were published, you know, 100 to 200 years ago, but even in architecture on buildings, you'll sometimes see the names of famous people literally carved into the stone. Or, you know, if you go to the main reading room at the Library of Congress here in Washington, D.C., it's a very big, grand, beautiful building. And there will be the names of famous writers and famous inventors stenciled up there on the wall to sort of, you know, inspire the current generation, remember great things that went before. So that kind of previous impulse to let's celebrate these great people from the past.
Yeah, and there's a few recent examples as well. Even in the 1950s, when Jonas Salk and his team, or someone else who announced it, but the team announced that they had got the polio vaccine and it was safe and they've proved it. They offered him a huge parade down New York, in New York City, and he did decline it. But they still were huge celebrations across America, especially across America at the time. When Cobden finished his free trade campaign, I'm not necessarily agreeing with this as a classical liberal libertarian, but the government celebrated him huge amounts and gave him funds to make sure that he wouldn't live the end of his days in poverty. So I agree with you.
And the, you know, when it comes to picking these people, so it's 65 people out of everyone who's ever lived in the history of the world. And so in the introduction, you go into a fair amount of detail about how you made these selections. And of course, you can't pick everyone. You can't pick everyone that's great. And you also can't necessarily, or you didn't exclude people just because they also did something else, which was not great. So there's people in here who owned slaves. There's people here who did all sorts of other negative things that we would not celebrate them for. Talk for a second about how you kind of, you know, finesse that idea that we want to celebrate person. And if you, you know, put someone on a pedestal like this, like including them in a book like this, I think they are, you are kind of putting them on a pedestal. You know, you only want praiseworthy people, but no one's perfect either. So you have to consider that, you know, the ratio of good to bad in someone's career.
Yeah, I haven't studied a hero who's praiseworthy in all aspects of their life, fundamentally. The definition I used as a hero of progress is someone whose work has saved or significantly improved the lives of millions of people. Sometimes it's hundreds of millions, sometimes it's billions. Regardless of their field, where they lived, how they liked their coffee, whatever, I didn't care. That was the sole definition I was looking for. But you're completely right. Some were committed egregious acts, held really repugnant views, especially for modern sensibilities, or were just generally unpleasant people to be around. A fair number of heroes of progress I would not like to have dinner with. They weren't the most pleasant of people. To give you an example of a couple of people who made the book but really committed awful acts were Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch, both Germans in the earlier 20th century. And one was a scientist, one was an engineer. And together, they created the Haber-Bosch process. Now, this process converts nitrogen from the air into ammonia, which can then be used as fertilizer. And this was at a time where there was a huge potential global famine on the horizon. Guano, which is bird poop deposits, were running out. And this saved hundreds of millions of lives back at a time when the global population was a quarter, if not a fifth, of what it is today. And yet, Haber went on to produce chlorine gas, which was used effectively in World War I first and in World War II, killed tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people. Karl Bosch, his collaborator in creating this process, went on to create nitric acid that went into saltpeter explosives, and his company got pretty rich off Nazi government contracts. And not all examples are that shocking and devastating on human lives. Others were just generally unpleasant people. There has been a fair amount of research on the link between disagreeableness and innovation. I'm not a psychologist or an expert in that field, but there seems to be a decent link. And we can see that in quite a few of the heroes. Maurice Hilleman's a good example. He's an American medical scientist who's said to have saved more most influential medical scientist of the 20th century. He created 40 vaccines. He created 8 of the 14 recommended on current schedules. And yet his according to a former mentee, his lab was operated like a military unit. He had a row of, they were later found out to be fake, but a row of shrunken heads on his desk to represent all the employees he had fired and gotten rid of. He refused to take classes from his employers that aimed to make civil managers, aimed to make middle managers more civil. And yet he saved tens, if not hundreds of millions of lives. And I probably wouldn't want to meet him.
Yeah, so these days, I don't think you're allowed to decline the management training. That is a sort of fascinating contrast, I guess. And, you know, it's something that I've thought about a lot, that in order to be a sort of, grand, heroic kind of person and to throw off everyone's criticisms of you, because a lot of people in this book had brilliant ideas, and then the sort of powers that be at the time, or the people, the gatekeepers in their industry or their profession, said, oh, you're an idiot, your ideas are crazy, this will never work. But they persevered. And in order to have that sort of unshakable self-confidence, I think you kind of have to, that often goes along with being kind of an abrasive jerk to people, right? You know, if you're going to live on a, you know, live your life with imperial certitude, that often brushes people the wrong way. But you have to do, otherwise you would have given up years ago in some of these cases.
Yeah. I think there's two key elements to this. The first is that, I guess to put it one way, is many were very good at processing information that doesn't correlate to the charming conversations we're having today. I'm not really in this debate too much. I look at a lot of the work done, but I've never contributed to it. But in the modern free speech debates, this is, I think, a bit of unexplored territory. But I think a lot of the heroes that were featured would have actually been cancelled or fired long before they made their innovation, if they were around in a modern workplace. So in some ways, these kind of modern cancellations can be contributing to declining future progress. And then the other sense of what you're saying as well is this sheer tenacity so many of these heroes had towards their work. So many worked over weekends. Some went through the media scrutinizing them. They didn't have Twitter at the time, but I'm sure Twitter would have been on fire. You had the inventors of a whooping cough, for example, Grace Eldering and Pearl Kendrick. They, perhaps due to some discrimination because of their sex and then also funding limitations, they weren't allowed to work on the whooping cough vaccine during their day-to-day work. So they spent all their weekends, their holidays, their evenings in the lab coming up for it. And they did so, and it saved 15 million lives so far. When Louis Pasteur, who's probably one of the slightly more well-known people in the book, as many are pretty unknown, we've got a few fairly well known, but mostly unsung. But when Louis Pasteur argued that life doesn't spontaneously appear from non-living matter, people thought he was absolutely crazy. And yet today, pasteurization, the germ theory of disease, revolutionized the medical industry and has saved hundreds, if not billions, of lives. And same with the inventor of X-rays, William Roentgen. He said, when he said to people that he could take photos of the insides of bodies 120 so years ago, people called him absolutely crazy. And yet today, X-rays are, most people listening have probably benefited from them at some point in their lives. So completely tenacious, often extremely disagreeable, but not always extremely disagreeable. That's some of the elements that make a hero of progress.
And, you mentioned how some of these people might be looked at in today's environment, but I kind of want to think about people who were very early on, people who might have been innovators in their own way thousands of years ago. Because you have a lot of impressive creators and innovators in the book, but I noticed they only starts really with Johann Gutenberg, who was born around, 1400 or so. And I assume that's not because there were no heroes of progress before the late Middle Ages, but that it's maybe harder to ascribe personal responsibility and agency for things that were invented thousands of years ago.
Yeah, that's right. And fundamentally, what I wanted to have in this book is definitive proof that someone did X thing. There's a lot of examples from 1,000, 2,000 years ago that claimed X person made X thing. But unless there is hardcore evidence available today, they have not been included. So that's why I think the most recent one was 15th century. Maybe some more evidence will come out for more historical innovations. But until that happens, I think I'll keep it as it is.
Yeah, and because I'm sure there was a brilliant Roman engineer who came up with a really great idea how to make arches better, but we don't know his name. But it kind of reminds me when I occasionally write things that are published by the Foundation for Economic Education, FEE, and they've got lots of outside contributors who have written things for them over the years. Yep. They recently did a website redesign, and so they redesigned the contributor pages, and they asked everyone had been a contributor to answer this little 4 or 5 question quiz to sort of get to know you better. And it one of the questions that I was thinking about while I was reading the book was, who are your heroes? Who are your, historic heroes? And I feel like there's a lot of names I probably could have mentioned, but I wrote one thing that I thought was more of a comment on the process, the idea itself, which is, there's probably all sorts of people who I would have considered heroes if I had known about them or if I knew about their lives, but because they weren't political figures or military commanders, I don't know who they are, right? There's probably millions of people who lived very exemplary saint-like lives or invented amazing, spectacular things far in the past. Until we reach a sort of, AI singularity, maybe, and we are able to rediscover all the lost knowledge in the history of the world, there's no way to know. I feel like in any list of great people, great heroes, we shouldn't set a few empty chairs at the table just to acknowledge there's all the people that probably would have been great. We just don't know who they were.
Absolutely. And there's also, when writing a book, there's also some discretion I had to take, because as we know, innovation is usually quite incremental. It's usually very collective, part of a network of information built on centuries of knowledge, and often requires a lot of people. So some really key innovations like the automobile weren't included because it's not actually, you can't really pin who invented the car on one person. You can pin it to maybe, if you've got a comprehensive list, a couple of dozen, quite a narrow list, a couple of dozen, but same with the aeroplane. Quite a few modern innovations that you might think should be in the book perhaps aren't, because I simply can't write a biography about the potentially thousands of people involved in creating Wi-Fi, for example. So many people have played a role in innovation over the years. I had to just choose who played the clearest and most important role in directly creating that innovation. And most chapters are one people, some are two, and one is three. And that is it. I couldn't really go beyond three. So that's how it's gone. But that said, I think this book provides quite a diverse sample of people you can really pin key innovations on. There are some more that I've got a Microsoft Word document that when people send me ideas for potentially future ones, I'm putting them in there. And since I finished the book probably about 10 months ago, and it was published last month. But since finishing the book, I've added a couple of more names to that list that maybe should have been included and I had just missed because there's such a diversity of fields. We've got agronomists, economists, to scientists, to writers, to innovators, so many different fields to explore. And it's impossible to capture them all. So it's very possible some people do fit this narrow definition of a hero of progress, but just their work isn't known about, or perhaps I missed it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're going to get some angry letters from people in Ohio and North Carolina for not giving Orville and Wilbur Wright the sole credit for creating the heavier than air aircraft. In addition to these sort of impressive accomplishments of individuals, you also make a point of emphasizing that sort of individual brilliance is often a necessary but not sufficient condition for these big advances in society to occur, you know, the kind that, you know, save hundreds of millions of lives, that we also generally see or generally need freedom and an open society, you know, surrounding that person. And I really was thinking of this, especially towards the very end of the book, when two of the most recent individuals you profiled, 20th century people, and I think living in the 21st century, Yuan Longping and Tu Youyou, both from the People's Republic of China. I guess it was they were born before it became the People's Republic of China, but they're both Chinese, and they had to contend in their career with Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution, which, among other things, was famously hostile to many professors and intellectuals and researchers. Do you think there would be more Chinese people in the book if China, for example, had developed a classical liberal government in the 20th century as opposed to a communist one?
Yes. So there's a huge link between freedom and the hero's profile. Completely not deliberate. As I said, I went into this book with my strict definition. I don't care on the field, saved or improved millions of lives. And yet what we found is the number of heroes significantly increased over the centuries. We had a couple from the 14th, one from the 15th, one from the 16th, one from the 17th. And then from the 18th century onwards, it just skyrockets up. And completely unintentionally as well, so does the diversity of heroes. I laid the book out chronologically, and as time goes on, the diversity of the heroes, as freedom grows, becomes significantly expands. However, there, as you alluded to, there are some heroes who did not come from a free society. And heroes not from a free society did one of two things. The first one was immigrate. Some of the heroes traveled relentlessly to seek new networks, freedoms, educations, that just wasn't available in their home country. One like Erasmus, who was one of the first first modern champion of peace and tolerance, he moved countries about six or seven times in the 15th century because he kept getting penalized in his home, in the country he was living, had to travel somewhere else to see if they'd tolerate his work. Admittedly, migration did decline a bit as the heroes, as we've got closer to modern day, perhaps because more free societies exist, so that people don't have to travel. If you're living in the United States 40 years ago and there's a decent amount of freedom for you, maybe you don't need to travel abroad to find more freedom, right? And the other thing heroes from non-free societies did in every case, apart from migration, was get special government permissions. Every single case. With Yao Longping, who you mentioned from China, he created hybrid rice, which saved hundreds of millions of people from famine. I think about 100 million people still rely on his grain every year. And he was actually initially targeted during the Cultural Revolution. The local government had a spot reserved for him in the local prison. They put his name on the cell and everything. And yet, fortunately, a party, a very high up party official from another province had read an article from him and wrote a letter. He was in such a position of authority, he could write a letter to give Yao Longping special permission to keep doing his work. And while that was, of course, amazing for Longping, you can just imagine, even to this day, the hundreds of millions, billions who weren't able to get this special freedom and weren't able to pursue any innovation or really test their idea in the marketplace. So I think freedom is one aspect. The human mind is another. And then also there is a degree of belief and having the skills available to pursue what you deem meaningful is absolutely crucial. And another example of someone getting special permission is Sir John Harrington, who's the inventor of a modern flushable toilet. He was a complete rebel in the the courts of the day, really like disrupting things. And yet he mostly got away with it because he was the godson of the queen. And the queen liked to give him a couple of punishments. But yet he could fundamentally have the money, resources to do what he wants. And just finally on that point, it's actually quite interesting is how, as we get closer to modern day through the book, is the diversity in terms of background, financial background of where the heroes come from, really increases from Sir John Harrington, who a wealthy British aristocrat, very close to a royal family, to others like, as we were just saying, Yao Longping, who came from nothing and had no money and yet still managed to change the world thanks to freedom available to them.
Yeah, and that's amazing how so many people, you know, will never have any idea that their lives have been impacted, have been made better, or in some places made possible by the contributions of a lot of the people in this book. You know, the millions of people who didn't starve to death in China because of that hybrid rice, you know, had no idea that that's only possible because someone who was delivering a letter from a party official in another province didn't drop it in a river by mistake. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, the sort of people who categorically are, you know, in this book versus not in this book. Like you said, there's a lot of diversity, especially as we get closer to the present day, between men versus women, people in different parts of the world, people with different socioeconomic backgrounds. And I sort of hinted at this before, that there's one group of famous and influential people that is very much not in this book, and those are military leaders. So there's no Napoleon, there's no Toussaint Louverture, or the Duke of Wellington, Douglas MacArthur. All those people are not here. Certainly some of those people would be considered national heroes, cultural heroes, or military heroes. But they're certain, but by this definition, they're not heroes of progress. But when it comes to sort of like the traditional impulse, like we started talking about let us now praise famous men, you know, this is sort of, those are the kind of people who came in for all the praise, right? In previous centuries. Why no military heroes?
Well, I think it's a degree of, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, alternative history, right? You have no idea what will happen if they didn't exist, and trying to figure that out is fun, but impossible.
I know a lot of novelists who have written a lot of catchy historical alternative history novels in that direction.
Yeah, and I love them, but there's no categorical way to prove if they're correct. And then also, I think there's a degree of the thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of soldiers under their command who also did the heavy lifting. So they might have come up with specific strategies and what have you, but fundamentally a lot of people were involved. But perhaps this is a decent point. Maybe I could have found a few more military leaders. I do have one more modern hero from the Soviet Union, who actually prevented all-out nuclear war. And his name was Vasily Arkhipov, and he was in charge of a flotilla of submarines during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And when he left Moscow in his submarine, he traveled all the way to Cuba. And in that time he was traveling, he had no radio communications, but the US had announced they were going to blockade Cuba. So when the US Navy found his submarine fleet underwater, they started dropping depth charges on him, which are small explosives encourage submarines to come to the surface. And what's interesting about this is, so on board, you must imagine the oxygen is dropping significantly. The tank controlling that had been damaged. You must also imagine the levels of, so the CO2 was rising. The temperatures were extremely hot. I think some reports were saying upwards of 140 Fahrenheit in some areas of the submarine. The captain of the ship and the political officer both said, this is, nuclear war has started, we need to launch our nuclear torpedo at the USS Randolph. And Vasily Arkhipov, even though he was in charge of the entire flotilla, he actually wasn't a captain or political officer on that ship. But because he so happened to be on board that specific ship within that flotilla of submarines, it meant in that instance, they needed his permission. Normally, they just need the captain and the political officer. But because he was there, they needed his permission. And he refused. He just said, no, we're not going to do it. We don't know what's happening. Eventually, they rose and returned to Moscow. And that's the end of the story. But it wasn't actually until 40 or 50 years later where we as the Western world found out that that submarine had a nuclear torpedo on. The US Navy was completely unaware until a gathering of former soldiers happened in Cuba on, I think it was the 40th anniversary. So I've got, if you can count him as a military commander, I've got him in there, but perhaps I could have a couple more.
You're right. That does that. He is, and he was a. You mentioned that he was an admiral when he retired. So he does count as a military leader, but he's a sort of like military leader in reverse, famous for not initiating violence.
That's coming.
And one thing that I noticed is that a lot of the especially the more modern scientists and medical researchers, they ended up working in industry or even starting their own businesses and companies. And, I wonder what people think about that between doing so-called sort of pure research in sort of a university versus working for a pharmaceutical company. I feel like there's a sort of cultural prejudice that like the university researcher who's not directly making money off of their research is sort of the higher calling, whereas the person who is the vice president of a pharmaceutical company is less praiseworthy. But it doesn't seem like it should make any difference if a million people's lives get saved.
No, and to be completely honest, and there have been examples of these innovators coming from industry, coming from universities, and indeed sometimes coming from government programs, unfortunately. as much as I hate to admit it as a classical liberal, there are a couple of examples of that. But a lot of the heroes did actually float between industry and academia in most instances. I mean, I think it fundamentally makes sense to do so. But it honestly didn't matter, and in some cases helped. If they were struggling with university bureaucracy, they seemed to have much more success running a lab at RAND or another similar company than they did in their university. So I haven't done the analysis of how many heroes made their breakthrough in industry, academia, government programs, or just they became an entrepreneur themselves, but perhaps I should.
Well, on sort of a similar topic, the very end of the book is a chapter on Bill Gates. And this is where I think this distinction is really, really obvious here, because you've got someone who is famous for founding a big company and making lots of money. And as you point out, enlarge global GDP, among other things, and obviously satisfied the needs of lots of businesses and individuals. That's how he made his money, right? People were willing to give him money to buy copies of Windows and other Microsoft products. And so he's sort of a big famous person for that reason. But then, of course, he and his wife started a charitable nonprofit foundation, which donated lots of money to things like that are very similar to a lot of other people in this book, which is donating money to medical causes, to stopping malaria, to saving lives, with medical interventions, especially in the places, some of the poorest places in the world. And so I think a lot of people would say, oh, well, Bill Gates being successful in business, that's great for him, but that doesn't mean anything for like the rest of the world. It's only the anti-malaria stuff that we care about. Right? It's only the Gates Foundation. But I think he deserves credit for the tech innovation as well. Yes. I mean, the tech innovation, Microsoft Windows probably did not save as many lives as the like anti-malaria campaigns funded by the Gates Foundation. But it seems like there's certainly some value to the business stuff as well.
Well, Well, absolutely, yes. I think his industry work is far more significant globally than his other foundation work. And while I think that the aims of his foundation are noble, especially as I'm now kind of in the foundation sphere, I don't think they've been carried out perhaps the best they could have. He was included because of what he did to industry and revolutionized all of our lives, not because of the work he had done via his foundation. Not to say someone could be excluded because they set up a foundation, but fundamentally, it's because of his industry work. I like to kind of joke, have a thought experiment. What would we all do if Microsoft Excel stopped working tomorrow morning? Everywhere, all at once, stop working. I think the global economy would crash. I generally can't see any other situation apart from huge catastrophe of the economy. And if it just crashed forever, so much is reliant on what he helped create. Admittedly, Bill Gates can be considered a bit more of a controversial one. I know a lot of people don't like him. And indeed, a lot of people were involved in the kind of the creation of modern computers as we know them. But I think the programs he created and the way he made them accessible to billions of people across the world every single day. It's not just a one-off thing that we use Microsoft Word or Excel or PowerPoint. It's every single day. And if they were to crash tomorrow, I don't know what I'd do. All my work will be gone. I'd be royally screwed. So thank you, Bill Gates.
You just need to get rid of those big portfolios of grid paper and copy every value down that you got in every.
Well, can you imagine? Yeah.
So to sort of wind up here, one person who I was the very least surprised to find in the book was Norman Borlaug, who was famous as a plant biologist and geneticist and helped create big advances in plant technology that fed lots of people, like a couple of the other people we've mentioned. And, you know, he passed away several years ago. But I was very lucky, and a few other people at CEI had the chance to meet him.
Oh, wow.
We gave him an award that we called the Prometheus Award for Human Achievement. And so far, he's the only one who's ever gotten it. It's a singular, no one else measures up to Norm. And especially want to mention him because of our previous back and forth about sometimes people who are great creators are also great jerks. That was definitely not true of Borlaug. He insisted everyone call him Norm rather than doctor, professor, or, you know, anything like that. And he was genuinely extremely nice to lowly people like me 20 plus years ago, who he had no reason to be nice to. sometimes there are heroes of progress who are great and you might want to have dinner with.
Absolutely. And Norman, thank you for sharing that story. I had no idea. And Norman Borlaug, for those who don't know, saved about a billion lives, if not more. It's hard to calculate. An American, completely revolutionized, I guess, farming as we know it. But yes, many were extremely nice too, and charismatic, I should say. The William Wilberforce, when he helped end slavery in the British Empire, it required his charismatic, charming personality. And same with Richard Cobden, when he did his campaign to ensure free trade in the British Empire too. Both Cobden and Wilberforce are Brits, I should add.
All right. Well, Alex, thank you so much for being with us. This is fantastic. And based on all the people that are now sending you submissions, maybe we'll have volume two, revised and expanded.
Maybe volume two. Maybe I could go in the opposite direction, explore heroes of regress and examine who caused the most harm and what drove them to do so. But yes, if anyone has ideas for heroes I shouldn't have included, I'm happy to receive them. I'm less willing to argue about why they weren't included.
All right. So before we go, where can people find you online? All your stuff, your social media?
Yeah, my main one is on Twitter, and it's at Alexander Hamo. And there's also a website dedicated to Heroes of Progress. I believe it's called heroesofprogress.com.
All right. Thanks again for being with us.
Thank you so much, Richard.
That's our show for this week. This has been episode 69 of Free the Economy. I'm your host, Richard Morrison. Our producer is Ryan Krasinski, and our technical advisor is Ryan Lynch. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all next week for episode 70.